Headlines: Moscow is about to expel several American diplomats in retaliation for Washington's expulsion of a dozen Russian representatives to the UN. More Western arms heading to Ukraine. Germany is sending 2,000 anti-tank weapons, and the UK will supply 6,000 new missiles. Also in the headlines, Iran says it is ready to finalize the agreement on the revival of the JCPOA in the near future if the US acts pragmatically. Thank you for joining us. And our top story: tensions ratcheting up between the United States and Russia over Ukraine. Washington says Moscow has expelled several American diplomats from the U.S. embassy, declaring them persona non grata. The State Department made the announcement, calling it another unproductive and unhelpful step in bilateral relations. Russian media, however, say the expulsions are in response to Washington expelling a dozen members of Russia's UN mission in New York last month. Simultaneously, President Vladimir Putin has announced that Russia's gas sales to what he called unfriendly countries would, from now on, be conducted in its local currency, rubles. The list includes the US, the UK, EU nations, alongside Japan and Canada. These are the countries that have sanctioned Russia over its operation in Ukraine. Political commentator William Jones says Russia's move to invoice some Western gas buyers in ruble shows that the U.S. cannot have full control over global trade.
Well, obviously, also, it's a defensive move. I mean, Russia has got to do what it has to do to maintain its production capabilities, to maintain as much of its trade connections as possible, and to expand those, perhaps selling more in Asia from what they're going to not be selling in Europe, because it's the question, on the one hand, of survival under very intense sanctions, but on the other hand, it's an attempt to indicate that the world is not totally controlled by the dictate of the United States, but that other options can be found. And the reason that Russia can do this is that Russia is not entirely alone. The general atmosphere, of course, is, and the drumbeat in the press particularly, is trying to describe President Putin as some demon who wants world hegemony, but most of the world just doesn't believe it. And most of the world needs oil and gas and wants development and feels that Russia is plays an important role in this.
Western governments are flooding Ukraine with more military and other types of support amid Russia's military operation. Britain says it will provide an additional 6,000 missiles. According to the Office of Prime Minister Boris Johnson, London will also provide around $33 million in funding to the Ukrainian military. That's besides over $5 million to support the BBC's coverage in the region. Johnson will announce the measures at the summit of the NATO and the Group of Seven on Thursday. The Prime Minister has already pledged to step up military and economic support for Ukraine. Germany is also sending 2,000 additional anti-tank weapons. It has already supplied 2,000 missiles and missile launchers. As Poland's huge effort to help Ukrainian refugees continues, it has been denounced by European countries' hostile approach to non-European refugees, which is again in the spotlight. Press TV decided to visit Poland's Muslim minority to see how they have coped with life in the conservative Catholic country. Robert Carter reports.
Poland's support for fellow Europeans fleeing Ukraine is receiving much praise. However, this has been a huge turnaround, for in past years, the Eastern European country has been heavily criticised for a proud anti-immigration stance, particularly hostile towards Muslim refugees.
Angela Merkel started this madness. And now this is a problem about Muslims mainly coming to Europe.
Amid the anti-Islam rhetoric, Press TV decided to investigate how local Muslims live under these types of challenges.
The Muslim community that lives here in Poland is small but very passionate. It's estimated somewhere between 25 to 40,000 Muslims currently live in the country, making up about 0.1% of the current population, as it's estimated. The majority of them are native Tatars, but also there has been an immigration of Muslims to Poland from various countries. We've come here to one of the main mosques in the capital, Warsaw, to meet the community firsthand.
The imam explained that his main focus has always been to re-educate Poles about Islam and demonstrate Islamic teachings through good deeds.
We teach Quran, we teach Arabic language, and we teach something about Islam. Yes. During Ramadan, because Ramadan is near now, we're making soon 1992, we're making food and iftar for everybody. Every day. From time to time, also, we're making open day. This is for non-Muslims to come to our mosque, to hear something and listen about Islam. We made in March open day, and during this activity, 5 women accept Islam.
Despite these successes, Islamophobia still rears its ugly head from time to time. But the mosque uses Islam to combat this also.
One time only, the Polish youth came in front of this masjid and said some bad words about Islam. But I went to them and invited them to here to take a cup of tea, and they became friendly.
In past years, it was Islamic immigration that was considered the major threat in Eastern Europe. Now it's Russia. But conflict in Europe has historically catapulted dangerous ideologies into the forefront. Muslims in Europe look on with caution. Robert Carter, Warsaw.
Elsewhere, Iran's foreign minister says an agreement to revive the 2015 nuclear deal is closer than ever if the U.S. acts pragmatically. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Iran is ready to have foreign ministers of countries belonging to the deal gather in Vienna to finalize the agreement. Iran and those countries have been engaged in talks for a year to revive the deal that ran into trouble because of the U.S. withdrawal in 2018. The Iranian foreign minister made those comments in a press conference with his Syrian counterpart. In Damascus, Amir Abdullahian and Faisal al-Muqdad discussed ways to boost bilateral ties, including on trade and economy.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus heading a high-ranking delegation. He met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed the implementation of bilateral cooperation agreements. Talks covered cooperation in fighting terrorism, in which Abdullahian renewed Iran's support to Syria for the full liberation of all its territories. The top diplomat briefed President Assad on the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA. Assad hailed Iran for adhering to principles and rights in the track adopted during the negotiations. He asserted that reaching a deal has become more important in service of Iran and the region's interest, as well as international equilibrium.
We had good meetings with President Assad and Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad. We welcome the new approach by some Arab states in restoring relations with Syria. We reaffirmed Iran's readiness to develop relations with Syria and discuss increasing the level of tourist exchange. We hope that in the near future, the presidents of both countries would meet.
A separate meeting was also held between the foreign ministers of Syria and Iran. Focus was laid on the notable increase of trade exchange and means of overcoming the impact of economic sanctions on the two countries.
We discussed means of confronting unilateral illegal sanctions on both states, as well as developments currently happening in the meetings of the Syrian Constitutional Committee in Geneva. Syria and Iran's stances are identical in this regard. We are in favor of a successful result. However, the other side is not working for national interests.
Syria was the first destination of the regional tour of the Iranian delegation, which also includes Lebanon. Abdullahian's visit is one of many exchanged between both countries' officials. It signals the extensive and continuous cooperation between the two allies at all times, which resulted in a defeat of terror in Syria and currently aims to boost economic partnerships. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps issues a strong warning to Israel, telling the regime to either stop its evil acts or face Iran's swift response. IRGC Chief Commander Major General Hossein Salami said Israel repeatedly makes miscalculations and everyone saw how they were targeted by IRGC missiles recently. Salami threatened Israel with more missile strikes if it repeats its acts of aggression. On March 13, the IRGC launched a dozen ballistic missiles at a strategic Israeli center located in Erbil, the capital of Iraq's Kurdistan region. The IRGC said the strike was in response to the regime's crimes. Several days prior to that attack, two Iranian military advisers were killed in Israeli airstrikes on the Syrian capital, Damascus. Political commentator David Yeroubian believes that the Erbil attack shows Iran's strategic patience has turned into strategic response.
This is the position of the Iranian government and of the IRGC, and it's being made very clear to the Zionists, the apartheid state of Israel, primary supporter of the United States, and the world, that Iran's period of strategic patience is over in this regard, related to all of the crimes and terrorism that the Zionists have engaged in that you just mentioned, and a new era of, let's say, strategic response, that is direct attacks for in exchange for Israeli attacks on Iranians or Iranian territory, wherever Iranians may be. And so whether the response, the ballistic missile strike on the Mossad outpost in Erbil was in relation to the killing of two IRGC officers in Syria or the attack by the Zionists, which was confirmed by the New York Times, having originated in the semi-autonomous Kurdish zone in Iraq, whether response to the Kermanshah base attack or the Syria attack, it is clear abundantly by way of the missile attack on Erbil that such attacks will be met with at least parallel attacks, if not ones of greater strength.
There's been a flurry of reactions to Tuesday's operation, during which a young Palestinian man was shot dead after stabbing to death four Israeli settlers. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has said the operation reflected the Palestinian people's resistance and their rejection of occupiers. It noted that resistance is the only path to victory and the full liberation of Palestine. Likewise, Palestinian resistance groups have heaped praise on the attack. Hamas called it a heroic act, illustrating the Palestinians' resolve to continue resistance until the liberation of the occupied territories. And the Islamic Jihad said the move was a natural response to Israeli crimes against Palestinians. A coalition of resistance groups in the occupied West Bank also warned Tel Aviv that it will pay for its crimes. Earlier, we reached out to activist and political commentator Mick Napier for his take on Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. He believes Palestinians have a lawful right to resist Israel's occupation of their land by any means they deem appropriate.
Anybody who looks at Palestinian resistance can look at it through a legal eye. The Geneva Convention, of course, justifies the right of people who are threatened with colonialism, colonization, and dispossession to resist by any means that they deem appropriate. But it's not only the Geneva Convention, it's any morality, any system of morality gives to people who have been abused, either individuals or whole peoples, the right to resist. And as the resistance factions in Palestine have stated, this is an inevitable reaction of what Israel is doing to the Palestinians. The settlers who were killed by the attacker are thieves. they're part of an overarching government plan, not only to discriminate against the Bedouin, but to drive them off their lands, to drive them out and make way for incoming Jewish colonists. And this isn't in the West Bank or Gaza. These, all the people concerned in this are Israeli citizens, the Palestinians, but they have no rights whatsoever against the Israeli program of ethnic cleansing.
Dozens of international organizations, human rights networks, academics and researchers from 45 countries are calling on the United Nations and Western countries to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shannon has more in this report from the besieged at the Gaza Strip.
A delegation from the International Academic Campaign Against Occupation and Apartheid headed to the offices of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, as well as the UN Special Coordinator's Office, UNSCO, in Gaza. They handed the memorandum on Israeli apartheid signed by around 70 international organizations, human rights networks, academics, and researchers from 45 countries. The campaign is calling on the United Nations and Western countries to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime for its occupation of the Palestinian territories and its apartheid regime. The Israeli regime is an occupying power and has kept the Gaza Strip under a crippling blockade since 2007 and also waged four wars on the tiny enclave.
We are here to condemn Israeli apartheid, and we call on the international community to support the Palestinian people. We also demand and end the Israeli crimes. Israeli leaders must face justice for their crimes against the Palestinian people.
Tel Aviv also practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
Ashraf Shannon, Gaza.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz. On behalf of myself and all my colleagues here at IRIB English Radio, we wish you a wonderful Nowruz, full of happiness and prosperity. Nowruz, happy customs in Iran.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with another episode of Nowruz special series. Feasts are the common feature of all cultures. Basically, a feast is a ceremony to pray and thank God for a victory or a great social event. Nowruz is an ancient national feast which has remained since thousands of years ago. It is rich in lofty human aspects. During Nowruz, many ceremonies are held throughout Iran. The first day of the solar year in Iran is the Feast of New Iranian Year. But it is not limited to Iran's geographical borders. It is celebrated in the vast area covering the entire regions of the Iranian culture. According to the statistics, at least 12 nations celebrate Nowruz, although each of them starts the feast according to their own national calendar. In addition to the nations within the domain of Nowruz culture, people in many countries celebrate Nowruz unofficially. India, Turkey, Egypt, France, Tatarstan in Russia, the United States, England, Canada, Netherlands, Germany, Lebanon, Syria, China, United Arab Emirates, and Sweden are among these nations. Today we are going to talk about various happy customs in different regions in Iran during Nowruz days. Stay tuned, please. Among the commonest symbols of Nowruz are Haji Firuz and Amu Nowruz. These two itinerant figures go in different neighborhoods of cities and try to make people happy by singing very simple songs as a promise of the arrival of spring and Nowruz. Haji Firuz is a well-known figure in the Iranian folklore. He brings the message of arrival of Nowruz. He is usually a thin man who has blackened his face. He wears cone-shaped cap and red clothes with pointed shoes. Haji Firuz holds a tambourine at hand and playfully sings very simple folkloric songs on Nowruz. Another figure who may be seen on the streets in Iran is Amu Nowruz or Baba Nowruz. This figure comes with Haji Firuz and is the symbol of time. He is an old man with white hair and beard, wearing a blue silk belt, a white shawl, linen trousers, and light flat shoes. According to old tales, he comes from mountains toward cities with a stick in his hand. Amu Nowruz is the husband of Nane Sarma, and these two symbolize the turning of the old day to the new one. According to the old tales, Nane Sarma impatiently waits for the arrival of Amu Nowruz, but she falls asleep and wakes up only to see that Amu Nowruz has come and gone. Thus, she forgets about him till next year. Dear listeners, as I said, there are many ceremonies in different regions of Iran during Nowruz. For example, the people of East Azerbaijan, West Azerbaijan, and Ardabil provinces hold a special ceremony called Tokamchi. Tokam is a wooden effigy of a male goat. Tokamchi is the person who moves the effigy in the air while singing spring songs. According to the ancient Iranian text, goat is the symbol of ascension, solidity, and fertility. Etokamchi usually comes from the mountain and reads out poems on Nowruz and generation. The traditional saya is another ceremony which is held by Azeri people of Iran. Saya means respect, and it is held a few days before Nowruz. Sayachi is the person who holds the ceremony. He's usually an itinerant artist who wears colorful clothes and goes from village to village and reciting happy poems on spring and Nowruz, gives the tidings of the arrival of Nowruz while beating two wooden sticks in hand. People used to give them wheat, barley, sweets, and money. Iranian Kurds, too, have had ceremonies to mark Nowruz. Mir Nowruzi or Kuse Gardi was among the dramatic arts which used to be held among Kurds. Mir Nowruzi is a comic show in which a person is chosen as the governor or administer the affairs. Villagers would wear farcical masks and see off the main showman, meaning Kuse, and his bride. The Mir Nowruzi group would go from one house to another to give the good tidings of arrival of Nowruz while reciting poems. Usually, they would receive gifts for their performance. The people of Khorasan in eastern and northeastern Iran also hold Mir Nowruzi or Nowruz Khan ceremony in many villages and nomadic regions. Mir Nowruzi is a comic show in which a well-built man with neat clothes is symbolically chosen as the governor. He rides a horse and starts gathering taxes and gifts from villagers. Some people play local instruments and sing folkloric songs to accompany the show. At the end of Nowruz, that is 13th of Farvardin, the villagers play instruments while dropping the governor in a pond. Then they take him out and, while taking off his clothes, cause him to wear simple clothes and tell him that he is no more a Khan. Well, dear listeners, next episode, we will talk about other Nowruz ceremonies in Iran.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Yemen now in its seventh year shows no signs of reaching a political resolve. But why? Why does Saudi Arabia continue a war that it is not winning on the ground? And why does the U.S. continue to support this war militarily? Just a couple of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. Let me first introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have Hossein Al-Bukhaiti joining us. He's an activist and political commentator who joins us from Sana'a. Also joining us is Hamza Karim. He's a political commentator who joins us from Toronto.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, let me first start with you, if I may. We're looking at a major attack that's taken place. It's not reported as such, but it really is a major attack. Drones that have hit the Saudi energy and water desalination facilities, looking at petroleum product distribution terminal in the southern Jizan region. I can go on with this list. It's quite an extensive list. Tell us the significance of this major attack. And what type of reaction mentally could Saudi Arabia be thinking of when it receives such a blow to its facilities?
I think what the Saudi Arabia have now to do is to accept that they cannot continue with this war and to accept that Yemeni army is well equipped to target all Saudi oil infrastructure and power plant and as well as they did today, water treatment plant. Since the beginning of the war, Saudi Arabia has enforced a blockade on Yemen, killing hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians. And since Biden sworn as U.S. president, he realized that military action on Yemen against Sana'a forces has failed. That's why they have, for the last year, tightened their blockade, blocking fuel from entering Yemen. And this actually affects all water supplies and electricity supplies in Yemen. Many hospitals are running low in fuel, and there are a warning that they might be closing. And Yemeni army, when he has launched his first attack, they call it breaking the siege operation. And today we have seen three operations against Saudi Arabia, which target mainly and focused mainly on Saudi refinery and oil infrastructure, including power station. I think that Yemeni army now want to send a clear message to Saudi Arabia that the fire that that you have created in Yemen, the suffering of Yemeni civilians will be sent back to Saudi Arabia. But as well, we see on the top of all that all this attack, that maybe it could be more than 40 ballistic missile and drone and drones and as well cruise missile has targeted Saudi Arabia. Not a single civilians was killed, and to show you the accuracy of these weapons used today. And as well, I want to mention that in all those three operations, they have used cruise missile, and we've seen in many footage released by some Saudi media showing some fire in some of those areas that was targeted. This shows that Yemeni army now has taken the decision to break the siege by attacking Saudi and by attacking their oil infrastructure, and they must stop, or they're going to see in the coming hours or days more attack against Saudi Arabia.
Okay, some good points made there, Hamza Karim, by our guest in Sana'a. In particular, what we're looking at, again, is the depth of the number of targets that the Yemeni army has hit. And our guest there talked about the precision. And that points to the fact that you're looking at the Yemeni army to have had major advancements in its arsenal throughout the years, this being one of them, which, again, it's surprising how it's not being reported. So if you take this attack and you cite all the different points, if you're Saudi Arabia, and then you take a look at, for example, the different accomplishments of Saudi Arabia, or should I say its mercenaries on the ground, You don't see a comparison that can be even made there, because the accomplishments by the Yemeni army far outweighs what Saudi Arabia has accomplished on the ground. Doesn't that point to Saudi defeat, which requires a complete revamp of the way they're approaching this war militarily?
Absolutely, definitely. You know, if we look at the war for the past 7 years, Saudi Arabia have used all their cards in this war, engaging in really heavy military operations in Yemen in different front lines. After that, they started tightening the economy of Yemen by closing the airports and the ports. They've used all the cards in Yemen to try to accomplish any of the objectives that they announced when they started this war in 2015. But after 7 years, we see that none of these objectives were achieved. And I believe, right now what they're trying to do is basically try to tighten more the siege that is imposed on Yemen to really put pressure on people and human beings there in Yemen. So this shows that really they could not accomplish anything. And, if I were in Saudi Arabia or to advise them something, is that, they need to change the way that they're dealing with this war. I think after 7 years and not being able to achieve any militarily or political, achievements there, they need to start thinking about this war in a different way. They need to start engaging in serious peace talks with Ansarullah or the government in Sana'a. There need to be some serious actions on ground to show that really they're changing of the way that they're thinking about this war. But we see that they still continue doing what they've been doing for the past 7 years, and they don't seem to be learning from their mistakes and the way they're dealing with this war.
Okay, Hussein Abdelkaiti, on the political front, there has been some movements made there by the UN. And I believe that you are of the opinion that the talks, which I believe were set to take place in Saudi Arabia, you believe that that is the wrong move, that the Yemen should not participate in the country that's doing the bombing. Also, there's a point about the siege, where the last time around where there were political talks, the siege was a point of contention where the Yemeni government said, listen, lift the siege. And yet Saudi Arabia did not do that. Why is Saudi Arabia not lifting the siege before we talk about the political movements taking place?
It's clearly that they are using the humanitarian crisis and disaster in Yemen as a weapon. All the ships that are that should be actually arriving to Hodeidah, either fuel or food, they have been searched by the United Nations and as well by the Saudi coalition. And there is a United Nations team after a Hodeidah agreement in December 2018 in Stockholm. That team has been working in Hodeidah for over 2 years. But still Saudi, because they have failed military, they think that using this humanitarian pressure, especially on fuel, which everything in Yemen and in any other country depend on fuel, they think as well in their media, they try to blame this shortages of fuel, to blame Sana'a government, because they think that they can deceive the Yemeni population. But on the other hand, we see that there are more people are joining the front line to fight Saudi Arabia. And as well, first part of your question about the Saudi suggested to have talks in Riyadh, I don't think, and as well, Sana'a should not accept this, because they have refused, especially Ansarullah, to go to Saudi Arabia before the start of this war, because Saudi has been playing a dirty part in Yemen by supporting terrorism, by supporting Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and supporting other groups who have been targeting Yemeni civilians, either by suicide or by killing or kidnapping. That's why, it will be really, really impossible that the same country that has launched the war and you denied and refused to go in the first week of that war to talk in Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia still consider what's happening in Yemen as a civil war. They think that they try to believe that they are not part of this war. And I think if Yemeni will accept that, this means that Saudi Arabia has won the war, because Saudi Arabia will not be obligated to pay any compensation for the killing of hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians or for the destruction that's happening in Yemen. And I think one last thing that when Saudi announced that they are ready to hold talks in Riyadh, I think because they know that the anniversary of the war, which is going to be on 26th of March, after maybe 10 days, they know that Yemeni army will launch a huge attack against Saudi Arabia. That's why they want to be to look like that they are the one who want peace. But I believe they do want peace. They just want to make Yemeni civilians suffer. And now the responsibility is on Sana'a government to stop all that.
Well, we need to talk about this because this is how this picture is being painted, Hamza Karim, in terms of how the media is wording the way that this war is taking place. And one of the things that is glaringly false is the following, where many media outlets say the violent struggle between Yemen's internationally recognized government, and I'm quoting, supported by a Saudi-led military coalition, and the Iran-backed Houthi rebels. Now, there are a couple of things here that are just false. When they talk about Yemen's internationally recognized governments, who is internationally recognizing this government is the first question, because when you look at what happened with elections, there was only one candidate, and that is not a criteria for a democratic election. And plus, when you talk about Abu Rabbu Mansur Hadi, most Yemenis don't recognize him as obviously their leader. Secondly, when they talk about this Iran-backed Houthi rebels, I mean, it's Iran does obviously support the Yemeni people. Why shouldn't it? They're being bombed. There is a harsh, severe humanitarian crisis. They're supporting that, but it kind of gives the idea militarily Iran is supporting the Yemeni army and obviously the Nasrallah fighters. Why is this false narrative being, do you think, described in the way that it is?
Yeah, definitely. You know, Saudi Arabia and the international media outlets, they've been, since the war started in Yemen, they've been trying to position this war as a civil war between Yemeni parties. Now, there's definitely some internal problems between the Yemeni parties in Yemen, but this doesn't mean that Saudi Arabia is not playing the biggest role in this war. Without Saudi Arabia, this war would never have happened. When we're talking about the internationally recognized government, it's basically the government that really U.S. and Saudi Arabia wants to for them to be running Yemen. So Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi was elected in 2014 in a one-candidate election for 2 years, and then after 1 year, they extended his presidency for another year. So basically, February 2015, Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi wasn't the president of Yemen, and the war was launched in March 2015. So even if we're talking about it from a legal perspective, he's not anymore the president. Now, when talking about Iran, now if you see Saudi Arabia, they've been supported by all the countries in the Western world. They've been buying arms from US, UK, France, Belgium, Germany, and a lot of other countries. How can you now, try to convince Houthis that they cannot have partners and allies? But for them, their Saudi Arabia has the right to deal with all the governments in the world when they want to impose on Sa'adullah and the government in Sana'a that they can't have partners and allies. This doesn't make any sense. Saudi Arabia can have their own allies. Yemen as well are allowed, and they have the right to decide who their allies should be.
Okay, Hossein Abukhaiti, the UN is trying very hard to make sure that talks take place. My question to you is, what type of talks can lead to any type of results or for the talks to be successful unless there is a party that the Saudi coalition or Saudi Arabia has in mind, somebody other than Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi that can be part of these talks? In other words, somebody that Yemenis also accept in order for there to be a compromise of any kind, if there is going to be one. So if they want to present Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi, how can the talks even lead to any type of success?
This is actually the problem, because when they call Hadi as the legitimate president or the legitimate government, Hadi, he won an election. He was the only candidate. And I mean, if the United Nations actually want to help Yemeni and to reach a peace deal or to reach a talk, they should at the beginning accept that the Saudi is committing a war crime against Yemen by blocking food and fuel, by closing airport and port across Yemen, by preventing ships and fuel shipment to enter Yemen. I mean, this is a war crime. It doesn't matter who's in this war. And as well, they keep calling the war in Yemen, they call it as a Yemeni crisis or a civil war. So if the United Nations will not accept that Saudi Arabia is a major part in this war, and as well Sana'a forces, and as well other parties, and at that point, then Yemenis, I'm sure that they will accept any talk, but it should be in a country that is not involved in this war. They have suggested many months that Muscat or Oman could be that place, but why Saudi Arabia did not accept that? Because they want to make a win from any political talks to be held in Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia actually want to make Yemeni feel that they are the one who opened Riyadh for them to reach a peace deal, and that they are the one who have struck this deal. But to be honest with the United Nations has been biased from the beginning of the war. And sure. As an example, the attack that has been taking place, as an example, on Sana'a many years ago, killing 1,000 Yemeni civilians on the Great Hall, funeral hall, United Nations has called it as an incident. And they have never, ever condemned Saudi Arabia. Okay. United Nations now, as well, is a biased, and they could not be part of any future deal.
All right. We have not talked about the U.S. here, which I'm going to ask you, Hamza Karim. What are we looking at when it comes to the U.S.? The media somewhat paints the picture now that they're somewhat confused as to what they're going to do. But when you take a look at the facts, arms sales continue. So what is the U.S. position in a minute, less than a minute, if you can say it?
Sure. You know, Saudi Arabia, this is their war in Yemen. U.S. is... This is the war of the U.S. in Yemen. Saudi Arabia is being used as a tool by U.S. We all remember in 2015 when the war started. It started from it was announced from the White House in Washington. Without the arms sales that and the logistic support and the intelligence support that Saudi Arabia is being given by U.S., this war wouldn't continue, okay. And Saudi Arabia wouldn't be able to defend itself. So definitely, U.S. is playing the major role here in this war.
Thank you for that, Hamza Karim, political commentator from Toronto. Hussein Abukhaisi, many thanks, activist and political commentator from Sana'a. And with that, we come to an end of this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tahwe and the entire team, is goodbye. Until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, sisters and brothers, ladies and gentlemen from every single corner of the world, wherever you are, welcome to your program. This is Arab English Radio. You're hearing me from Back to Reality. I am your humble host, Asma, and here with me I have two very dear guests, Brother Hassanain and Brother Sayyid Jaffa.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Very pleased to meet you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you for having us. Thank you for being here. So, as the ritual of this program, at the very beginning, we ask about the academical background of your study. So, shall you please tell us a little bit about your study?
Yeah, sure. I'm Hassanain and I'm from India. I'm an Islamic seminary student and studying in here in Qom.
So, wish you all the best. And you, brother? You.
My name is Sayyid Jaffer. I'm from America. And I, myself, am also a seminary student. Studying here in Qom.
So wish you luck. Thank you for being here. Well, in today's Back to Reality, we're going to discuss the Mother Tongue Day. Have you ever heard about it in past?
Not in past. Like, I just heard about it because it's a month of February. And I know, like, it's observed, like, globally on 21st of February. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, International Mother Language Day. Well,
to be honest, Before this, I have never thought about it. There is an international day for mother tongue. So there's a day for mother tongue, which has been celebrated all around the world. Can you please tell us a little information about Mother Tongue Day?
As I said before, like, it is observed globally on 21st of February.
Mm-hmm.
So the main idea is to recognize and promote multilingual diversity. So it also, this day, it also, you know, aims to preserve and transmit traditional knowledge and cultures through multilingual societies. Now, you see that, you know, that many people, they live in a country, but they originally belong to some different countries. Like, their ethnicity is not as the country that they're living in.
Mm-hmm.
So they have the language that they speak in their country, and they have one language, which we refer to as mother tongue.
Have another language at university or at wherever they're studying.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like Sayyid Jaffer, him being an American, so his language is English. But I guess his mother tongue would be considered to be as Urdu.
I wasn't born in Pakistan. I didn't live in Pakistan. My mother tongue is English.
So?
Because I was brought up in that
language.
Yes, that's very true. That's what I'm trying to say. Like, Sayyid Jaffer, him being an American, he speaks in English, right?
Yes.
But his mother tongue is supposed to be Urdu. So the idea of Mother Language Day is the same thing, like, to preserve the multilingual diversity.
So
you know, you should preserve your mother language.
Sorry, just to step in. Brother Jaffer, speak of yourself right now. Do you speak English at home?
At first, I did, because that was the only language I knew. So, obviously, I spoke the language that I knew. But later on,
your parents spoke in Urdu, right?
They spoke in Urdu. I couldn't respond back in Urdu. I would I would understand Urdu to an extent, but I would respond back in English.
Just like what happens to other multilingual children. They understand their parents' language, but they cannot speak.
But they can't speak,
yes.
That was the whole idea, mm-hmm. to preserve their, you know, their own language, I might say, or their traditional language, mm-hmm. or the mother tongue. So this idea was approved by UNESCO in 1999.
So the idea is to keep the mother tongue language alive. We have studied something in linguistics that they do care about all the languages to stay alive. Even there are some specific languages they've been spoken in some remote villages. They try in order to keep them alive, in order not to forget about those languages, because all those sets of rules are very important. So aside from that, let's come to this very point that why do we need to have a unique language in which it turns into an international language? Do you think there is a need for it to have an international language?
Yeah, I believe that the need for an international language is there to help different people from different parts of the world to, I guess, interact with one another.
To communicate.
Because if you have two people that speak two different languages, again, they're going to speak in their language to the other person. and neither one is going to understand the other,
mm-hmm.
right? When you have one language that's used amongst all the countries, it leads to less disagreements and issues because of, say, not understanding the other person's language.
You know, yeah. I guess two questions, I feel that...
You agree, first of all, you agree to have one international language?
That's why I say, like, the two questions arises over here. Should there be a common language?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there should be one. Because, you know, it'll be easier for, you know, like interacting with
and
others.
And what's the other question?
The other question is, which language should it be? I his say language. It should be my language.
And
he
I
says
have
that
another
it should be
question.
His language.
Who decides which language?
Exactly. Which language should it be and who decides it?
Yes. So right now, let's go for a little break and we'll be back after just a short interval. Thank you for listening, guys. Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email that is englishradio@irib.ir.
We should look at the language with the most common speakers. We might say, like, you know, this language is spoken most in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So we can make this as a common language or like international language.
So can we consider
people.
English as a common international language?
One more
nowadays?
Question. One more question arises over here.
We
question
need some
is,
answers too.
Is yes. English the international language? It's been made the international language. You know, it's been forced to, you know, on people of different
mm-hmm.
societies.
Yes.
Like, you know, I'm from India.
So you mean there's an agenda behind the scenes?
Yeah, because, you know, you are the native of that language, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I guess that's in some point that's beneficial for you. Because in India, the language was Hindi and Sanskrit.
Exactly.
And, you know, and Urdu as well. But then these, when the Britishers, they occupied India.
Yes.
So they changed the language over there. They implemented, you know, they started schools in mm-hmm. English language.
Yes, that's very true.
So, but now, like, what I feel like is, you know, once now it has been the international language.
But India not being occupied, English would have not been prevailed that much, right? In India.
Yeah.
I feel like the language that's become the most, I guess, the most common international language was also based on who had, I guess, the most land. Who took over the most?
Conquered more of land.
Exactly. The more you conquered, the more you were going to give
it's
your own language.
It's the story of colonized countries.
Exactly.
They
so because Europe and England colonized
yes.
most of the world,
mm-hmm.
their language reigned supreme amongst the whole world because they had
that's the point.
A foothold everywhere.
That's the
but
point.
But the whole idea about languages, you know, it's good, like, you know, to, you know, learn different languages.
It's
very never
good
a bad idea.
Different languages.
Yeah, because, okay, nowadays, you know, English is used, like, more. It's
mm-hmm.
more common between the people.
Yes.
Like, you know, if we go around the world, like, you know, travel anywhere, like, you know, English has been spoken. English
now
is spoken in most of the countries.
Do you think, do you have any possibility for this thing that I'm saying? Do you see any possibility for English to change into another language, for example, Chinese? To be the international language, for the Russian language to be the international language.
I don't think that'll happen.
Why not? Russia could take over the world. Russian is the new
yes.
language.
If that happens.
The new power.
No, if that happens, yeah. They'll just simply remain as an international language and no one will care about that.
That's what she's asking,
yeah,
right?
So you won't go.
Any country that's the superpower mm-hmm. has the control, like, their language will become the international language.
First, let's talk about what do we mean by international language. Are you talking about the language that, you know, that's used in the international meetings, like, you know, the official, the governmental meetings?
No, that is being used in most of the countries.
A language,
you know,
that can be used from two different countries,
two
different cultures.
The second language of many countries. The second language.